This is Ovinology.
Welcome back, Ovinologists. I hope you have your play clothes on, because today we're going to get dirty. Get it? Dirt. Dirty. First, a few announcements. With the grazing season coming to an end, members of the Ballyhoo U flock are about to be released for sale alongside the many eligible bachelors we have on offer. If you're looking for a starter flock, outcross ram, or fiber friend, please visit ballyhoofiberemporium.com and click on sheep for sale. Fall shearing has started at Ballyhoo, and we have Gotland lamb fleeces, as well as Akoya's Icelandic fleece, Jacob's adult fleece, and several Shetland fleeces from spring shearing. Please contact me if you're interested in purchasing raw wool. Typically, I post pictures of the fleeces that are available on my Instagram, ballyhoo.fiber.emporium. I'm not sure if I'll be doing that this fall or not. It just sort of depends on time. So if there's something you're looking for, don't hesitate to reach out. Don't forget there's more to learn on Patreon at patreon.com/ovinology. You'll find recipes, tutorials, and more for as little as just a dollar. In case you're wondering, and I probably should do a better job of updating this on Patreon as well, those funds go toward making this show possible. It is just me researching, writing, recording, editing, and managing everything, and that's why you don't hear credits at the end of the show. Your contributions also get passed to worthy causes. In the past year, we've assisted pets with cancer, mothers and children leaving abusive situations, shepherds recovering from illness or catastrophic injury, grassroots farmer networks, and more. I really do appreciate your support and patience. As I said, Ovinology is a one-woman show, and so, for the most part, is Ballyhoo Farm and Fiber Emporium. I've been stretched thin, practically transparent this year as I've dealt with one death after another. It's been a tough old 2023, and I hope you know I'm doing my best. So thanks for listening. Okay, in the last episode, we looked at what makes a ruminant, how they digest cellulose, and why ruminants are critical to maintaining healthy vegetation. Now it's time to dig a little deeper and sink our hands into the force that feeds us all, Earth. Only by knowing how dirt, grass, and ruminants work together can we form best management practices. So get your shovel and your sample bag, and let's get started. Some of you may live in areas that have already experienced a killing frost. Where I farm, daytime temps are still near 90, and overnights are in the low 50s. But that's all about to change. This is an interesting time as the needs of ruminants and forage species are very much at odds. Fall is breeding season, a time when animals naturally flush. There's your farmer vocabulary word of the week. Flushing means the animal is suddenly getting a lot of nutrient-dense food, a sudden burst of calories and a fat cap that will see them through the winter. This triggers a female's body to say, yeah, you know, times are good. We can handle gestation. Go on ahead and breed. 2023 is a mast year for oaks and actually for rose hips as well. Now, scientists aren't sure why, but every few years, all the oak trees, all of them, everywhere, produce a ton more acorns than average. They also don't know how the trees decide to work cooperatively. So in a mast year, tons of acorns means, first, tons of protein for a lot of different critters. And, of course, those critters, some of them, squirrels, are gonna, well, squirrel away their nuts, and that results in more trees for the oak species later on. Number two, less parasites and ruminants because acorns and everything about oaks is very tannic. This does give the grass a little bit of a break, which is also critical this year because we've had very widespread drought. You'll recall from last episode that grass follows the adage, as above, so below. Whatever vegetation you see above the soil, that's how much root the plant has. In a drought year, that's a problem. Under constant trampling and grazing, the plant is so stressed that it can't reach down to access water and poof, it dries right up. At least the moisture and nutrients from urine and manure are helping to shade the soil and feed the grass, but eventually it isn't enough. If the grass is lucky enough to make it to fall, it's also desperate to cast seed and grow enough root to survive the winter. You see, a greater root reserve allows the top growth to survive frosts and heat better, and more top growth in winter, even though the plant is dormant, creates a thermal conduit that will melt snow around the plant, making water available in the soil, and helping it restart growth earlier in the spring. So we have two very important goals here. For the ruminants, eat enough to get fat and have babies. And for the plants, grow enough to spread babies and survive dormancy. All right, we're going down. Now remember what the grass roots do for the soil? How they open little pockets for water to penetrate and be stored? Well, they also make channels for oxygen. The microorganisms that break down dead roots, manure, dead animals, etc., into organically available nutrients only exist where there's oxygen. On its own, oxygen only permeates about 5 inches below the surface. That's a little less than the length of your hand. That precious 5 inches is called topsoil. It's composed of 25% air, 25% water, 5% organic matter, and 45% inorganic materials, such as clay, sand, silt, gravel. Now, all life relies on topsoil. It takes about 100 years to build. For thousands of years, that was just fine. Nature had a system, and we worked within its constraints. But then, we had something called the Industrial Revolution. We invented tractors. We thought we could do better than nature. We tore up the topsoil through cultivation. Cultivation did aerate the soil. Tilling brought oxygen down to places it had never been. However, tilling loosened the topsoil that only organic material holds together, making it vulnerable to wind and erosion. Remember hearing about the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression? That was almost 100 years ago, and we still haven't learned. All that precious topsoil blew away. It ran into our rivers, streams, took root in our lakes as silt. We lost our bioavailable nutrients. So we developed chemical fertilizers, soluble fertilizers. We opened the earth and filled it full of stopgaps to force it to do more, better, faster than it could handle. We found a workaround. But we haven't repaired the damage we did in the first place. We're not building back. Enough about Big Ag. Let's get back to hooves on the ground. Now, variety is the spice of life. It's the lifeblood of the pasture. The holy triumvirate of soil, plants, and ruminants need the same thing. Biodiversity. Not every animal species eats the same plants. Not every microorganism processes the same organic material. Not every plant gives or takes the same nutrients to and from the soil. There are two basic groups of forages, cool and warm season, and they grow just like they sound. Some like cooler temperatures and die back in the warmer weather. Some thrive in warmer weather and die back when it starts to get cold. Even though it's invisible to the eye, the growth cycle of a healthy meadow, prairie, or pasture is exactly like waves in the ocean. As compatible species grow, mature to seed, and die off, others that prefer a different pH or temperature range sprout up, grow, and mature behind them, and so on through the year. Plants are palatable at different stages of their growth, and some that aren't palatable to grazing animals still play an important role. Alfalfa is extremely palatable, even for humans, but it can kill a cow in certain times of growth. So why add it to the plant community then? Well, alfalfa is a legume, and legumes fix nitrogen to the soil by drawing it from the air. Nitrogen is used by all plant species, and if we use more than we replace, there's none left for anybody. So planting cover crops of legumes, such as winter peas and alfalfa, maintains soil health for the entire area. Additionally, alfalfa, like some other plants we consider weeds, has extraordinarily long tap roots, up to 20 feet. Oxygen can only permeate 5 inches, and other forbs and sedges only send down roots inches to a few feet. So deep-rooted species that are able to break through inorganic matter to draw up crucial nutrients from the earth make those nutrients accessible to neighboring plants. But wait, there's more! Those nutrients and minerals, which are invisible to our puny human senses, are like LED billboards to ruminants. Believe it or not, they can see the difference in light refractions between healthy and unhealthy plants. Of course, they can taste higher sugar and nitrate contents, and they can smell where the soil and plants are most beneficial. Observation is our best friend. It's our first line of pasture management. Watching what our animals eat and where they avoid, as well as their overall health on pasture, will give us a good idea of how it's doing. We can also observe which plants are thriving, and this is one of the primary benefits of weeds. Now, everywhere you see an quote-unquote undesirable plant, there's a message about your soil or pasture health. Stocking rates are too low to eat the plants, or too high for the grass to outcompete the weeds. Thistles tell us that the pasture has a phosphate imbalance, while broadleaf plantains warn of compacted soil. The solution is often the weed itself. For instance, allow the plantain to break the soil with its root system, and it will die back and the grasses will thrive. A healthy prairie or pasture includes a buffet of plants and provides ruminants with a self-serve apothecary. Rose hips are high in vitamin C. Poplar leaves and dandelions flush toxins from the body. Bitter tannic plants, such as oak, flush parasites. Plantain, burdock, and yarrow are antiseptic. Curly dock is high in iron, while buckwheat, horsetail, and stinging nettle are high in calcium. And let's not forget that aside from ruminants, these species are providing forage and habitat for other animals as well. For instance, the goldfinch thrives on thistles. I hear your lingering question. Poplar leaves? Acorns? I thought we were discussing open land. Why are there trees? Most pastures and meadows are bordered by trees, and lots of farmers plant a few trees for shade. It's important that trees be protected from animals for the first 5 years to establish healthy roots and enough canopy growth to withstand being nibbled on. Most trees pretty much grow like shrubs, and they develop their classic trunk and canopy shape because of animals eating their lower branches. We humans just went ahead and copied that with pruners. We need to discuss trees because we've already established that grazing can impact wildfires in a positive way. The use of grazing animals, pigs, cattle, sheep, and goats, within a grove or forest is called silvopasture. It's really great in extreme seasons, winter and summer, as the trees provide shelter from snow, heat, and wind. Pigs and cattle are amazing bulldozers. They'll knock down brush and small trees, trample them into the earth, and this makes organic matter available to the microbiome, which in turn turns it into humus. Not hummus. That's delicious for humans. Deer, elk, moose, and other animals provide this service already, but we're doing such a bang-up job of cutting wildlife off from their habitat that they can't take care of business. So, we turn to sheep or goats and put them out in the forest while things are growing. They gobble and trample the understory, they prune low-hanging branches, and then when it's time, we take them home. In late summer and fall, there's way less risk of forest fires because there's little to no dead matter to act as tinder. It also takes quite a while for leaf and needle litter to break down and become humus. While the organic matter from trees does fall on aerobic soil, a dense pack of leaf litter can smother microorganisms, And with little airflow or animal movement, there's no turnover for this matter to churn it into the dirt. Silvopasture can speed this process, as manure and urine add to the top of the leaf litter, and animals' hooves trample and churn it all up. Whew, that was a lot of science. There's so much more, which I will leave in the show notes for your capable fingers to access when it's convenient for you. We now know what a ruminant is, why they're best designed for grazing, how they interact with plant life cycles and soil health, and why that's all important for us. Now, we turn to vegetation management. Mowing versus grazing. I'm gonna assume that everyone here knows what mowing is, how it works, and what it requires. Just to recap, mowers, the machines, need fossil fuels and they're carbon emissive. Landscape crews require manpower, although those people are getting paid and contributing to their local economies, so really that's in the pro column. Back to carbon emissions, however, think of all the places that use mowers. I don't mean at home. We'll just ignore the American lawn for today. I mean everywhere that uses a mower, either a zero turn, a tractor, team of weed eaters, blowers, and requires at least one pickup truck and trailer to get the manpower to that site. Think about it. Churches, hospitals, parks, graveyards, schools, mediums of roadways and interstates, office complexes, shopping centers, pet training and boarding facilities, public and corporate walking spaces, rest stops, zoos, museums, wedding venues, racetracks, restaurants, hotels, banks, golf courses. If it has a bush, a tree, or a strip of green, someone's being paid to manage it. Does that mean we shouldn't have green spaces? Of course not. If anything, we need more green space. But our method of management bears examination. Can you imagine a world in which schoolyards are grazed during the summer break when no children are on site? What if you went to grandma's grave and you saw a flock of sheep resting peacefully nearby? What if you went for a run in the park? And around a bend, you spooked a herd of goats browsing just off the path. What if we all got used to seeing healthy grass, including our lawns, 12 inches high? Just a foot. About 4 times the usual height of a manicured lawn. The grass would be 4 times healthier on its own, without the need for spraying herbicide or soluble fertilizers, which can't be fully used by the plants anyway, and generally end up running off into our wastewater. What if we incorporated healthy animals into healthy green spaces in urban settings? What would it take for that to happen? Find out as season 2 of Ovinology continues. Again, you can take a deep dive through the show notes if you'd like to learn even more about soil health. I've included a book, links to 2 different websites with scientific studies, and a wonderful podcast that I recently learned about. It focuses on mycology, which is the study of mushrooms, but there's a lot in there about what goes into soil health and what grows healthy plants. Join the Patreon for as little as a dollar at patreon.com/ovinology. Rate, review, and subscribe to Ovinology to help us get found by others. It's just one way you can make the world a better place with sheep.